the Chronic Life Podcast, where life is lived well. And now your hosts, Dr. Kevin Payne and Don Peterson.
Now that I'm sick, who am I? Everyone I know who's dealing with a chronic condition deals with identity and how it affects the way they see themselves.
So the story we tell ourselves, the picture we have of ourselves, all of that begins to change when you're suffering from a chronic condition. What way do we change?
Well, in a lot of ways. You can kind of start with, well, what the heck is an identity? Really, it's how we answer the question, who am I?
When do we ask that question? I guess, you know, it's funny you bring this up, and I think, you know, there are going to be some great parts of this episode that are going to help educate me as well. When do we ask the question, who are we? Because in my view, what we're talking about is a comparative analysis. We're comparing what we were to what we are.
Mm-hmm.
And why do we ask ourselves that question? Is it a sense of security or lack of security? Who am I? Why am I this way? Or how do people perceive me? And so when we're diagnosed with a chronic condition, or we put a name on the chronic condition that maybe we've been dealing with for a long time, we become strangers to ourselves?
It's a really good question. When do we ask, who am I? You know, I'll tell you, a lot of people, I think, really need to ask themselves that question more often than they do.
Well, I know the question I always ask myself is, why the hell did you do that?
Yeah.
Or why were you thinking that? Or why did you assume that or presume that, right? So it's really, I question sometimes what I consider to be my characteristics in terms of how people would look at me. And I always sort of self-analyze and go, well, why the hell would I do that? Or why would I have thought that?
Right.
And then I try to correct whatever that bias is or that feeling. But I guess what we're saying in this context of a chronic condition and dealing with the symptoms that result from it, that your self-perception changes.
It does.
The question you're asking yourself is, how am I different? Mm-hmm. Is that the question? How am I different?
Yeah, it's how am I different now compared to who I used to be? Or if it's something that you've had all your life, it's you're asking yourself, well, how am I different from other people who don't deal with this sort of circumstance in their own lives? Think about it this way. Most of the time, and I wasn't joking when I said, who am I is really the question. And as a matter of fact, there's something called the Iowa 20 Questions Identity Inventory.
Iowa, like the state of Iowa.
Yeah, like the state, because it was done at the University of Iowa.
Okay. I just didn't know it was some, you know, big psycho word that, you know.
Yeah, no, it's not a psycho word this time.
It's
just a state.
Yeah,
just a state.
All right.
So, and all you have to do is write the question, who am I, at the top of the page, number down the side 1 to 20, and then just answer the question. Whatever it is, don't censor yourself. Don't, you know, try to think of things that make sense or don't make sense. Just write down the first thing that comes to your mind, and then the second thing, and then the third thing, and the fourth thing, and just go through it.
So it's like an inventory.
Yeah, and it's called that's right. It's the 20 Answers Identity Inventory. And so what we're doing is we're just kind of looking at, well, when you think of yourself, what are the kinds of things that you think of? Now, for most people, if you look at those 20 things, an issue related to health is probably not going to be on that list because we take it for granted. So you'll have things like your roles, like I'm a father, or I'm highly educated, or I like, you know, peppermint ice cream, those kinds of things. And those will be the kinds of things that you answer. But for people with chronic conditions, you'll start seeing elements related to your condition creep into that inventory, or you'll start finding items on that list that reflect limitations that you're experiencing now.
So these are labels, in a sense, that we attach to ourselves, like, I'm a father, I am a brother, I'm a son.
Yeah, those are all roles, and that's one kind of thing.
I'm good looking and I'm smart and I'm tall and handsome and all those. I mean, those are all characteristics, though, aren't they? I mean,
yeah, they all tend to fall into four different groups. So we will put physical characteristics in there. Yeah. So you may say that you've got brown eyes or long hair or gray hair or, you know, whatever it is. And you may say that you're fit or you're unfit in some way. And those are really common. You may say that you're left-handed or right-handed or whatever is important. And then the second bundle of things tend to be social. And those include like the roles that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So if you're married or not, or if you're looking, or if you're a father or son, or whatever it is. Maybe they're related to your profession. All of those are social kinds of qualities. Then the next group of items that we tend to see on the list are what we call reflective. And those are, you know, I'm considerate. It's you making judgments about yourself, right?
Which are generally wrong, right?
Yeah, often, you know, they may or may not be right.
Well, I think we all have a very distorted self-perception.
Yeah, some are more distorted than others. Well, but, yeah. But yeah, none of us are accurate.
Yeah, I mean, it's by degree, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And then there's kind of this last group that's this kind of the ooh, hippy-dippy sort of wacky things there. It's called oceanic self items. So it's like, you know, I am one with the universe, or I'm a lover of small, fluffy animals, or whatever it is. And you'll see those kinds of things. They don't fit into neat categories. They're just kind of existential statements.
Well, I was actually just going to ask that question because it sounds almost existentialist to me. Because much of, and I think about myself, and so I, you know, this is my role on this show, by the way, is I talk about myself, because it's all about me, and it's always been about me.
At least you're interesting.
Well, I try to be, because, you know, that's one of my roles, or at least my purpose. But again, it's about purpose, right? I mean, that's existentially, I think about, why am I here?
Mm-hmm.
What's my role in this world? What am I contributing to mankind, and what's it contributing to me? And I think we do get a little sort of out there about some of these kinds of questions. And yet I'm gathering from the context so far that you've laid out that this is a really more practical inventory or assessment of ourselves. This isn't that sort of existentialist, you know, why am I here and what is the meaning of life and all those things, right?
Well,
or is it?
There's no guidance on this. I mean, literally, it's just who am I? So with some people, whenever they answer this sort of thing, it'll be lots of really physical, concrete sorts of answers. For other people, there'll be a whole lot of those oceanic kind of selves. It's really interesting. We've seen a cultural shift over time. So if you go back to the 50s, and you did this to Americans, which they've done, you can see that most Americans were anchored in that physical mode during that time. So more Americans would have the largest proportion of their answers in the physical category. When we get into the 60s and the 70s, we start seeing a shift to the social mode, and more people would answer more frequently with those roles and relationships and that sort of thing. By the time we get to the 80s and ongoing, we see more people anchored in the reflective mode. So there has been a shift, a cultural shift, over time.
But why? That's fascinating. I mean, I guess I hadn't even thought about that, but I reflect on what you just said, and I'm thinking, well, that's really kind of right.
Mm-hmm.
But why? I mean, has life changed? Have the forms of communication, the urbanization, leaving agricultural lives behind where we were isolated? Like in Kansas, you know, I live in Kansas, right? But I live in the northeast corner of it where most of the people are. But once you step outside a city limit in the state of Kansas, the population density is like 2 families per square mile.
Right.
So if somebody asked you, well, you know, how would you identify if you're one of those 2 families that, you know, are living in this 1 square mile? Well, maybe your sense of self is much more inward than it would be in a more social environment where you're actually around more people. Is that why it's shifted?
That's part of it. So there have been demographic shifts. There have been geographic shifts through that, you know, a little more than half century now. There have also been cultural shifts where, you know, in the 50s, we had a culture in the United States that was more concrete and more oriented toward homogeneity and similarity. And then in the 60s and 70s, you've got all of the movements that are happening, and there's more reflection on social values and our connections to one another. In the 80s and going forward, you've got sort of that me period where we're focusing on self-betterment and self-actualization and those sorts of things. And so you see that as in a reflection. I've actually done this. This is one of those things that I do this every 6 months or so, and I've done it for close to 30 years now, almost. So I've got a really interesting longitudinal picture of myself and how I've changed in the way I see myself over time. And one of the things that I've noticed is that if you go to all the years before I was diagnosed, health was never an issue. The only thing related to health that you would see on my lists was that, you know, I like to exercise, lift weights, you know, do things like that. And then since I've been diagnosed, and not just diagnosed, but especially if you look at when I was going through worse periods with my health, because MS cycles up and down in the way it does. And there would be some of these issues that would creep into how I was seeing myself.
So it changed your story.
Yeah,
it changed my story. The story you tell yourself about yourself shifted.
Exactly.
As you became more symptomatic or expected to be more symptomatic over time. So time matters, right?
Yeah.
So this is a time-based assessment, and it shifts over time.
It does. And so it's one of those things that I would encourage everyone who's listening to take a few minutes and do this. And I'll actually put together a little document that they can download from the site that helps people make sense of what's going on. This identity thing is one way for us to get at, well, how am I thinking about myself? And looking at the new constraints that our health status puts on us whenever we have to deal with it.
Okay, we're going to take a bit of a break, and when we come back, we're going to dive deeper into, well, is this just the way I am now, and why?
We all have challenges. Mine is multiple sclerosis. We each have this one life, and we didn't choose to be saddled with chronic illness. But there's a better way. So I choose to just jump. And you can too. It's your life. Live it well. ChronicCal.com.
And we're back. I'm still Dr. Kevin Payne, and he's still Don Peterson.
I looked.
And we're still the Chronic Life Podcast. Today we're continuing our discussion of identity. It's this whole, now that I'm sick, who am I question that we all ask. To get deeper into this idea of identity, part of our identity is what we call our dispositions. They're just the way we are, right? Some people tend to be normally happy. Other people are more morose. Some people are very friendly. Other people are more distant. And all of those things, it's not like we as individuals don't vary, but we tend to have a baseline that we go back to.
Yeah, but I think that the way I look at it, and I could be wrong, so I know you're going to correct me if I am, which is fine, that we're really a composite of things,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we have our own sort of self-perception, and then we have what we think other people perceive us as,
yes.
Right? And we identify with our work or our hobbies or various things, right? So it's really more of a composite, right? It's not just
Yeah, it is.
One identity.
And
right?
Actually, if we got into the whole technical part of it, which I promise we won't, we actually measure it separately. There's how you see yourself, there's how other people see you, and there's even one step beyond that, how you think other people see you.
Right. And so the process really is merging all those things together,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And from that, you have this, identity. Right?
Yeah, and there are significant predictable problems that occur when I see myself one way, but everybody else around me sees me differently. And some of those are related to what happens with chronic illness, because in some cases, I recognize that there are many, many ways that I'm still the same person as I was before I had a multiple sclerosis diagnosis. But other people can see maybe only that diagnosis. And they see me as fundamentally different. And I'm in here saying, wait a minute, there's this big disconnect.
And that's changing their perception of you. Mm-hmm. But when you merge all of that together, it then disrupts, in some respects, how you identify even yourself, right?
It does. It does. And it makes it harder for me to operate in the world, because now I'm trying to get where I want to go, where I see myself, but there's an additional obstacle because other people around me are acting like I'm different somehow.
Well, but is it, I'm thinking of other things in life that occur, right? You get mm-hmm. married, now you're not just you're you and your spouse, right? Or a job, right? Mm-hmm. You're a data scientist, social psychologist. At one time, you were a professor, and maybe professorhood was something you identified with, and maybe you still do in the same way, but others won't because you're not a professor at this time, right? So that's shifting your own identity?
Yeah, that was kind of a difficult transition for me. The way I split the difference in my own identity was I still think of myself, even though I'm a businessman, I still think of myself as an academic.
Yeah.
Because I'm still a scientist, and I still do research, and that's relevant to what the company does, and I still do a lot of teaching, because that's part of what the company does.
But it's still disrupted that time.
It did.
Your view of your own identity, and my guess is then a chronic disease diagnosis is going to disrupt it similarly.
Yeah, it does. But there's one fundamental difference that we often see with a chronic illness compared to those other examples. And that is, with all those other examples, there are positive and negative things that come with those identity shifts. With a chronic illness, it's almost all negative that's associated with it. And so, because there's nobody that's, unless you've got Munchausen syndrome, you're not running around saying that you want a condition.
Well, yeah, nobody's going to come over and congratulate you, right?
Congratulations,
right. You got MS.
So it
is a negative. It's not like you just had a birthday,
mm-hmm.
right? So I could see where, yes, from a self-awareness perspective, right, mm-hmm. it's got to be negative.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it is. And that's difficult to reconcile, because here's this great big negative that's been plopped into the middle of your identity that you can't ignore, because there are real medical and physical issues that are involved. And yet, every time you have to deal with them, if you have to deal with them all the time, then it's grinding.
Well, it just reinforces the fact that your identity of yourself has been that disrupted.
Right? Exactly.
It's kind of like when people, I would think, it's like losing a job or going through a divorce or, having a serious breakup with somebody that you, had thought you were going to be with for a long, long time. And that just changes, everything, right? I mean, yeah. I have friends who've been divorced and, they have to separate their group of friends and who they socialize with and things like that, right? And that, obviously, now you're in a whole different group, or people that you thought cared about you, had to make a choice. I mean, it's got to be disruptive. And a chronic disease diagnosis that other people really can't empathize with,
mm-hmm. yeah.
that kind of leaves you, where it's just you now trying to figure out, right,
it is.
How
it
to
is.
Deal with it.
And there are ripple effects, which I want us to make sure that we talk about in this segment. And that's, if I'm a very open person, or say I'm naturally someone who is prone to liking new experiences, okay? So there are some parts of our disposition that are really big and they affect a lot of things. Like openness is one of those. Now, if I have a chronic illness that I have to navigate, that might cause me to have to pull in and not take advantage of some of those new experiences that I would like to have because I don't feel like I can physically handle it. It not only changes your identity in the sense of having this big negative thing that's plopped in there with you, but you have to start accommodating in ways that change your other dispositions.
You know, it's funny that you frame it that way because I was listening to a podcast that Joe Rogan was doing with David Sinclair. David Sinclair is a geneticist, biologist who is working on things that will help stave off aging, right? So he's got this whole thing that he talks about and the chemicals and the cell division and the other things that tend to be corrupted over time. You know, every time you divide the cell, errors are, you know, injected into that process, and over time those errors build up, and that's kind of what the aging process is.
Entropy.
Yeah, there you go. he said, yeah, there's a callback. He said that, you know, what we haven't done yet is created a diagnosis for aging, right? But all the things you just mentioned, you know, changing your lifestyle, setting aside things that you used to do, you know, not adventuring out to do things that maybe you would have done when you were younger, those also, as I've noticed as I've gotten older, are impacting me. And it's changing the way I think of myself. Because when I can't do something or I don't go off and do something that I would have otherwise done, because I'm like you, I'm kind of the adrenaline junkie, you know, type A. Mm-hmm. In the past, there was almost nothing I wouldn't do, which sometimes got me into trouble. But and I'm not going to go into detail on any of that stuff. But now I hold back and I go, I'm only holding back because I've gotten older.
Yeah.
I'm only holding back because I'm not sure I can do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an acceptance or a self-awareness that is changing my identity of myself. It's
right.
Changing the way I think of myself.
We have to become more self-aware of those things and really make some decisions here. Is this truly something that I have to pull back from? Or is it something that maybe I can be a little creative with and come up with a different way of getting there?
Yeah. You know? There was an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal just the other day about exercising as you age.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a series of exercises, and it said, you know, when you're between your 30s and 40s, you could do these things, and when you're in your 40s to 50s, you could do those things, and from 50 to 60, you do these things, and 60 to 70, 70 to 80, I mean, it just went on to this whole progression, and the only thing that was consistent about the whole progression is that as you got older, you did fewer things,
mm-hmm.
or you did fewer repetitions of it. Yeah. And I thought, well, that just reinforces this whole notion that as you get older, you just can't do stuff.
Well, you know, I take some issues with that, and mm-hmm. I think one of the things that I do to try to keep myself feeling like myself is that exercise is really important to me, and I love lifting weights. You know, that's just always something that I have enjoyed doing, and so I've got a great gym at home. I've got, you know, just tons of equipment, and I do the same lift, you know, at knocking on 50 that I did when I was 25.
Yeah.
I do the same, you know, I do the same lift. Well, mentally it helps that my mental age stopped at 28.
Well, yeah, I guess it's that I have that problem too, that I don't know whether that's Peter Pan syndrome or whatever it is, but it just seems like in my head I'm about 20 years younger than I actually am chronologically.
Yeah.
But in my head I'm like still a nutty kid who mm-hmm. still hasn't figured it all out yet. And probably never will, I guess.
I don't expect I ever will.
Yeah,
but I mean, these are all things that we want to, you know, that we have to deal with when we're trying to negotiate our identity. And there are other parts, like there's another part of our disposition that's sometimes referred to as like neuroticism. Some people worry more than others. You know, and that's just a baseline. And you know, my mother has never met a worry that she didn't want to consider,
that she didn't own.
Yeah, and you know, she's very serious about those things. Me, I get concerned about things, but I don't ruminate. But a chronic illness often causes people to score higher in that neuroticism.
You mean they become more neurotic?
They become more worrisome.
Well, why wouldn't you?
It's rational.
I would think that's a natural reaction.
It's rational,
right?
It's rational.
Yeah.
But concern and worry are different things.
Concerns and issues, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, there are rational concerns that are real, practical, external things that we have to accommodate. Worries, on the other hand, tend to be things that we manufacture ourselves. They're about how we feel about it. And so, you know, we have to be very careful to acknowledge that, you know, living with a chronic condition, there are things that we have to legitimately be concerned with.
Yeah.
And things that we never were before.
When do you get to the point, you know, it's like my aging or my concerns about aging, right? I don't worry about it, but it's just something I can't stop, right? The clock just won't stop.
Mm-hmm.
I've come to, after sort of denying and doing some self-deprecating humor about it, people are like, Don, just own it. Just own it. You know, it's like the white hair or gray hair or whatever. It's just, don't worry about it. Just own it. Mm-hmm. And does that happen, like, with chronic diseases? At some point in time, you just got to own it and say, like, okay, this is me now, and I own it. And, you know, I'm not embarrassed by it. I'm not worried about it. It is what it is. I have to accept it as my reality, and I'm just going to own it.
Yeah, acceptance does not diminish you. And too often we think that if we accept it, if we acknowledge it, it's going to somehow make us less.
Yeah, and I think it's just the opposite.
And it is.
I think,
it is.
Right?
Because, you know, once you own it, that doesn't mean that you're giving up. It doesn't mean that you're giving in. It means that you are intelligently taking account of it so that you can work around it or work through it or work with it and still get where you want to go.
Yeah, it's like you were talking about the exercising, right? So you just modify what behaviors you have to modify, accepting that that's what my new reality is, and just make it part of the tapestry or whatever, the construction that you are. Right. It's just part of that group of things that become your identity, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's not going to go away.
No,
so
it's not.
So you have to at some point you have to be accepting of it, right?
Yeah, and I want to emphasize that being accepting does not mean that you're not going to be carefully limit testing.
Right. Yeah.
You're always going to kind of probe the limits of what you've been able to do, because it can change.
Well, I think in our previous episode with Danielle, which mm-hmm. Which was outstanding, by the way. You know, when she talked about her cancer diagnosis and the fact that she's had it twice now, even though she's in remission officially, she still thinks about it. It's still part of who she is, and she's, like you say, not testing, but she's always aware of it.
Right,
and it doesn't. It doesn't abide, you know, a cavalier attitude. It's something that she has to be legitimately concerned about probably the rest of her life.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, before we go into another break here, the last thing I wanted to really emphasize is that even though we all have dispositions, that doesn't mean it's what you're stuck with. You know, there's actually one part of our dispositions is whether we have a fixed or a growth mindset, you know, where we are on that continuum. And so the upshot of this is many of us feel like, well, this just is the way we are, right? They're not going to change. The thing to remember here is that popular phrase, you can if you think you can. That's bull, okay? But, and I'm going to get bleeped for that, but it is. But what is true is that if you can't, if you think you can't, you won't. But if you think you can, you might.
Well, I think that's what it is, right? I mean, the fear of failure is in my opinion, oftentimes why people don't do things.
Yes.
Not that they're afraid of trying, they're afraid of failing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have a fail culture. We talk more about when others fail as opposed to when they succeed. Because there's this schadenfreude, whatever it is, that we... And we see this, like, you know, a Bill Gates or, you know, anybody who's been wildly successful. There are just hordes of people who think he must have done something wrong to get there.
Yeah.
Right? But yet we root for the underdog all the time, almost all the time. Right? But as soon as the underdog becomes the lead dog, we want to take him down. I think it's a form of, I don't know, schizophrenia we have in our society. It certainly is a huge dichotomy. But we do tend to, I don't know why, relish in, this is what gossip is mostly about, right? It's trying to take down somebody else. And
well, there actually are explanations for that. It's a whole other episode. But you're right in that. And I think the important thing for people to realize is we are not as fixed as we think we are sometimes. Because sometimes we can get into a rut and we can think, oh, this is just the way I am, this is just the way it is, and that's all it's ever going to be. But if you look at the data, and there have been a few longitudinal long-term studies where they've measured people like when they were teenagers and then all the way up to when they were in their 70s. And if you look at their personality and dispositions over that time, how they were as teenagers only predicts about 50% of the variation of how they are as elderly adults. So the point is, we change a lot. We change a lot more than we think we are. If we think we're fixed, we have a lot more opportunity to change and grow and work with the limitations that our condition puts on us and our identities. And we'll be right back after this.
We all have challenges. Mine is multiple sclerosis. We each have this one life. We didn't choose to be saddled with chronic illness, but there's a better way. So I choose to just jump. And you can too. It's your life. Live it well. ChronicCal.com.
Welcome back. I'm here with Dr. Kevin Payne. This is Don Peterson, and we're talking about identity and how a chronic disease diagnosis disrupts that identity and how we accept and become aware and, well, reconstruct our identity around these new diagnoses. But I think, Kevin, you made a great point during the break about how it's not a consistent thing, right? You can, like, sort of accept what's happening to you right now, but it doesn't stay like that.
Yeah, it's sort of like The Godfather 3, you know? Just when I think I'm out, they're pulling me back in, right? Yeah. You know? Yeah. And just when you think you've got your new normal kind of negotiated for yourself, then chronic illness has a way of just sneaking up and smacking you upside the head. And now something is different or something is worse, and you have a new set of concerns, or maybe old concerns that you thought were resolved, rear their ugly heads again. And so I think one of the best ways to think about what we're dealing with here is lasting and repeated trauma.
Yeah, that's a good point.
What we're talking about in this episode should resonate with people who don't think of themselves as living with chronic illness, but who have been abused or are dealing with post-traumatic stress or if they're dealing with disadvantage in some ways, that leads to many of the same kinds of faulty adaptations that we've been talking about, because you've got to accommodate those things in your identity.
Yeah, but you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about the difference between worry and concern. And it would seem to me that every time, you know, your chronic condition smacks you over the head again, right, what you thought was a concern now becomes a worry,
mm-hmm.
right? And you can take that too far. As you said, worry can be debilitating, where concern is, okay, maybe more constructive. I understand this is what's happening. here's how I can best deal with that, or at least you sort of watch yourself more closely and say, okay, if I eat these things or I exercise this way or I sleep this long or whatever it is, I'm dealing with it better. So you have the concern, but you have a way of sort of constructing a new reality, as you point out,
right?
In ways to deal with that. And then all of a sudden, somebody lowers the boom and a new thing happens that's part of your condition. You got to start over?
Well, it's concerns become worries when they start folding back on themselves.
Yeah.
And when you start ruminating about them. Because our emotions are like the weather. Our emotions are naturally up and down and they change. And, you know, wait 5 minutes and it'll be something else. We actually have to work to worry for a long period of time. We have to keep focusing on it and keep refreshing it and keep ruminating on it and keep fixating. And a lot of this comes from a chronic illness, from the fact that, you know, in our identities, we're always telling these stories about ourselves, and we're the hero of our own story, and we want to show our control in the world, and we're faced with something that we can't control. And that often leads to worry.
Well, because in some respects, I mean, I'm just trying to expand a little bit in layman's terms on what you're talking about, because I get it. But when you're hit with a new symptom or something that didn't occur before, and you fixate on it, right, which I think is another word for worry, you're really just trying to reconcile, okay, this happened, right? You're fixating on it because it actually happened, right?
Yeah.
And you're not inventing it. I mean, to me, a lot of things that actually I worry about, I'm inventing my own head. I'm fixating on it because I shouldn't be. It's not a rational decision to do that because I can't change the outcome. So why am I worried about this? It's a concern, something I have to deal with, and I play out in my head all the different scenarios. But when it comes to a chronic disease, you can't play out all the scenarios because you really don't know sometimes what potentially could happen to you.
No, you really don't. And there are many different kinds of worries. You know, there are prospective worries where we're worrying about what's going to happen in the future. There are retrospective worries when we're regretting something that and trying to replay it in the past. And concerns are different. Concerns are always about what we are dealing with right now or, you know, immediately facing. And they're focused on identifying the reality and finding a solution.
Yeah, and I think most of us would sort of reflexively analyze what's going on, right? It's a reflex. It's like you said, it's traumatic, right? So it's an acute thing, it's an emergent thing, and that we have this reflex that says fight, flight, you have all the terms, but I mean, in basic terms, it's fight or flight, and you don't want to be a victim of it, but we talked about, you know, warrior mode, and you don't want to fight it either, right? Yeah. Because that drains you of energy and other things. So I get it, but I'm intrigued by this whole topic because, you know, I can see so many parallels to other aspects of life. You know, we talked about it, divorce and, you know, losing your job and or whatever it is, and how that can be an assault on your identity. But a chronic disease, it's also an assault, but it's, as you say, it's forever, right?
Right. Or you know, like we had a perfect example in our previous episode with Danielle. I mean, technically it's over for her, but as she and I talked, it's not over.
It's never over. I think anybody with a cancer diagnosis, our producer Mindy has had her own experience, it's not something that ever leaves you, right? It's always there as a potential because you know your predisposition to it.
Well, and I've experienced that as a caregiver where, you know, my then wife and I were sitting there in the physician's office after the surgery and all the tests and everything, and she was literally told, "You're cured now. Good luck."
Yeah.
You know, with well-meaning, cheer. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. No, it's not that easy.
Yeah, it's very dynamic,
right?
I mean, when it comes to chronic disease, not knowing exactly what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen, you kind of just have to gird yourself for it, right? You just got to sort of buck up and say, okay, these are all the things that could happen.
Yeah.
And, right?
And a lot of it is about cultivating resilience, which is...
Okay, that's a great point.
Yeah, which is a topic of a whole episode that will be coming here. And that's really important. And part of it, you know, one of the things that I want people to take away from this episode is that there's some big things about our illness that we may not be able to handle. But we can get small wins that add up. And you know, those aggregate to something really important. And so part of our identity is all of the things that we claim in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, it's your physical characteristics, your traits, your relationships, your experiences, the cultural products like the books and the movies and things like that that you like. And chronic illness sometimes, even when we're not noticing, can kind of urge us toward losing some of those. Like I did with skydiving for a long time.
Yeah.
You know? And so we have to become more conscious of that and try to keep hold of those things that we can in our identity, because that gives us a win that we can point to.
Yeah. And you know, as we're wrapping up this particular episode, I find all of this very fascinating. I still have one question, and I want to surface this a little bit. I know we can't spend, you know, a lot of time on it because we're running out of time, but we talked about early on that identity is something that's also made up of the people around you, mm-hmm. right? How other people mm-hmm. perceive you. And as a caregiver for somebody with a chronic condition, you want to foster as much positivity as you can, but you mm-hmm. want to do it realistically, because I think that the individual who has the chronic condition, if they see you, you know, overly cavalier about it, trying to make, you know, it's no big deal, you're going to be fine, we're going to be great, and there's no real sort of recognition of the reality of this condition being serious and, you know, and likely, you know, changing the arc of my life. Where do you draw that line? You know, you want to empower people. You want them to feel positive. You want to be a positive influence on their lives. But I think there's a line that you cross when you're overly positive, right? Because don't you have to, kind of like you as the individual who has it, you have to have some self-acceptance, right? You got to accept this reality. Yeah. How do people who are caregivers, you've done this like with your wife who, you know, suffered from cancer. How do you do that as a caregiver? What recommendations? I don't think there's a one answer. I'm sorry. I don't need to put you on the spot or think there's a silver bullet for this.
There isn't a silver bullet, but it begins with communication. You know, I'm reminded there's actually a set of instruments that I use where, you know, they're survey type instruments.
Like the Marquis de Sade kind of instrument?
Well, no, they may seem like that, but I, you know, I devise them for disentangling dyadic relationships between two people. And so it really is about there's one set that says, how do you see yourself? And then there's the other one that says, how do you see the other person? And then there's, how do you think the other person sees you?
Right, right. Well, that's where I'm at.
Right, because, and you both do it. And the algorithms in the back end compare how much they don't fit. And that turns out to be a place where you can work on improving the relationship and communication. And that allows us to see a disconnect between how others expect you to be and how you are. And a lot of times what we're reacting to are these expectations that we're just kind of filling in the blank with. And our identities are not individual. Just think about this for a second. If we were not social, we would not have identities.
That's interesting.
Yeah, there's absolutely no reason to have an identity if you're only you. Identities are, by definition, social. We only see identities in social animals.
Fair enough. Okay, I'm processing that. That's a deep concept. I guess I hadn't really thought about, because you think that no matter, much of your identity is and I'm just talking silly layman terms here, but is about self-awareness, right?
It is.
Well, so if you're self-aware, are you saying then that that awareness is relative to the social environment around you?
Yeah, that self-awareness beyond, say, basic instrumental action, you know, just about getting something done, like eating, sleeping,
yeah,
you know, using the bathroom, those kinds of things, there would be no reason for almost any of that other stuff, and we wouldn't actually get to it if we didn't have a shared culture, right? So your identity, that sense of directedness and that story that you impose on all of it, is a result of us being social animals.
So largely, then, the externalities, what's around you. So this is like, I'm thinking about the movie that Tom Hanks did where he's lost on an island and makes a friend out of a soccer ball, Wilson, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, he found a purpose, and that was delivering that last FedEx package that washed ashore, right?
Right.
Refused to open it, even though there might have been food in there or clothing or something that would have helped him survive the island, right? Mm-hmm. He refused to open it because his purpose was, like, I get off this island so I can deliver this package.
Right.
Right. And that's a lot mm-hmm. of us need a purpose, right?
Right.
We have to have a reason. But yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, from a social perspective, he had to find a way to create, well, or construct a social environment so he could survive being alone for so long.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And as we will discuss in the next episode, part of this is about, you know, if we are never actually alone. We are always at least with ourselves. And you always have a relationship with yourself.
I'm talking to myself again, and oh my, I'm answering too.
Yeah, and sometimes yourself is a jerk.
Oh yeah, I've been there.
No, I never have.
No, I have. Yeah, like, shut the hell up, yeah, Don. You know what you're talking about.
All right.
Better you listen than talk.
I hope what people have gotten out of this is that our health status is really deeply tied to how we think about ourselves and how we feel about ourselves and how we see ourselves and whether we feel we're worthwhile or useful and about how other people see us as well. And it's not like with other aspects of our identity where there's some positives and negatives that come along with each. It's pretty much a big negative lump that is thrown in with us. And we have to negotiate all that lasting and repeated and surprising trauma to reform our story, to accommodate it, but not to be limited to only our sickness and our identity.
And I think that's what I'm taking away from this, and I hope the listeners will too, is that your identity really is dynamic and fluid. It is going to shift, and it has shifted, like you said. You know, half of who you are today, you were not that person 20 years ago or 30 years ago. You've grown up and changed half of yourself or more. And certainly a chronic disease diagnosis is going to disrupt your identity. But there's been other disruptions in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And you've learned by, you know, experiencing it, that it is dynamic and fluid. And that this is just one more, well, bump along the road of the life that you've been living. But it's a serious bump, and it will continue to change and disrupt who you are and how you look at yourself, right?
Exactly. And I think this has provided an excellent foundation for a topic that we'll be returning to many times in this series, this idea of identity and ourself and trying to renegotiate who that is with the real demands that our health and the practical consequences place on us. And so I think that's a good place for us to leave you until next time, when we'll talk about alone versus lonely. And those are two very different things.
Sounds good.
This has been the Chronic Life Podcast, where we live life well. Join the conversation on social media at Chronic Life Pod or at chroniclifepodcast.com.